The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome everyone to this joint GGV96 and Seneca podcast live recording. I'm Zara Zhang, and I'm joined by my 96 co-host, Hans Tung, managing partner at GGV Capital, and by Kaiser Kuo, host of the Seneca podcast and producer of the 96 podcast. Please join me in welcoming our special guest, Professor Yasheng Huang. We're delighted to have Professor Huang with us today. He is the International Program Professor in Chinese Economy and Business and Professor of Global Economics and Management at the MIT Sloan School of Management. And he's the founder and head of the China Lab and the India Lab at MIT.
Yasheng, I'm so glad that you could join us here. It was such a pleasure talking to you for Seneca last year in San Francisco. Your straight talk and your frankness is always quite the breath of fresh air. So let's deal with the elephant in the room first. I think we all know that's the trade war. We've seen volleys in both directions now. First, the steel and the aluminum tariff, and then a very subdued Chinese response. Then you had the $60 billion putatively over the 301, the WTO complaint. Then China's announcement, and now just on Thursday this week, a threat of an even larger tariff of $100 billion by Trump. So it's quite clear that the Trump administration really is focused, is opposed to one particular target of this tariff. I mean, it's China's new tech-focused industrial policy that's called Made in China 2025. America has basically always opposed industrial policy. You had Meiji in Japan in the 1980s, which is a target of American ire, for instance. What is it that they object so much to in Made in China 2025? And is there actually something to object to? Is there something that's deliberately quite unfair? Stay very close.
Okay. Thank you, Kaiser, and very good to share the podium with Hans and Zara as well. Yeah, this is a big elephant in the room. And I think the possibility is a real one that things can get out of the control, right? So essentially, you have an escalation of the conflicts. And the more you escalate, it's more difficult to walk down from that high position that you have made very, very clear. And so in terms of your specific question about what the U.S. Is objecting through this tariff action, I guess there are kind of three things and falling in two categories. One is a macroeconomic one, which has to do with the trade imbalances, and there are different calculations about exactly what is the right number. But I think by and large, there's a decent consensus that U.S. has a persistent trade deficit with China. Maybe the size is not as big as they say. Complications are enormous in terms of the how do you count processing trade and things like that. So that's one. That's on the more macroeconomic side. On the more sort of microeconomic side, this has to do with the issue of IP, right? So Trump actually used that term, which is IP theft, right? And we can have a debate whether or not trade tariff is the right
remedy
instrument
for it, right.
To deal with that. I don't think it's the right instrument to deal with even the macroeconomic issue, but for macroeconomic issue, it's definitely the wrong instrument. And then there's the political sort of security issue, which has to do with how a incumbent established power deals with a rising power that has such a fundamentally different value. Political, economic, right, socioeconomic institutions and values, right? And that's unprecedented.
Yeah, it's a multidimensional near.
It's multidimensional. There was Soviet Union before, But Soviet Union, we kind of always knew their weaknesses, right?
Right. And they had great ballet, but what consumer products did we want? We wanted like a Stolichnaya vodka, very good vodka, but nothing much else we want from Soviet friends, right?
Yeah, but there's nothing to be trivia about ballet. I mean, Soviet Union had science, right? There's an excellent...
They launched Sputnik before us, but little basketball, it make beep, beep noise. But
I won't compete with you in imitation of Russian accent. But, you know, Soviet had science, Soviet had physics, Soviets had biology and chemistry. The fundamental difference is
WeChat. They didn't have WeChat.
They definitely don't have that.
they didn't have that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But neither China at that time, right?
No,
so let me put it point that out. But the
fundamental
difference is that Soviets never used their science for economics, right?
But.
And so there was a gap between how advanced the science was, which was mostly geared toward defense,
right?
Sputnik and all of that, we all know that. It was never really applied to economic development. So Soviet economy was horrible, right? Whereas the country actually had, you know, established the scientists, excellent scientists. There's a great book, by the way, written by an MIT historian. The title of it is Lonely Ideas. Mm. The book is about how the Soviets invested heavily in science and technology, heavily in science, but never gained benefit from that, right? So this is a huge difference between Soviet Union and China.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think the fear on the part of the United States, let's sort of separate two issues. One is whether we should fear China from the US point of view. The other is whether or not superficially there is an objective reason for an average person in the United States to say, wow, look at that country that has a sort of a nominally communist system and you know, one-party system and all of that, plus science, plus technology, plus hands, right?
So plus economic benefits.
Especially the hands equation,
right.
Which is really a, you know, to
tips
that
the balance.
Person,
you're talking about VC,
the VC, right? So the ecosystem. So if you look at Boston, Silicon Valley, right? Basically, you need three things, right? Scientists, scientists / technologists, entrepreneurs, and VC. China has all three, right? So, you know, we can debate about the quality and the quantity is impressive, right? China now, in terms of, you probably have more data than I do.
Quantity has a quality all its own, right?
So size matters, right?
You have both, Kaiser.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, sometimes you do have trade-off. But the thing is, let me put it this way. If you don't have a big scientific establishment, big VC establishment, the probability of having stellar science and stellar investment is actually low, right? So you kind of need a size because precisely the probability is low. You need a size to make the absolute number high. And this is really, in terms of country-to-country comparisons, it is the absolute number that matters, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not so much the ratio to Chinese, you know, success rates and, you know, if you can use sort of the success X's and maybe that can be low in China, but as long as the number is large to the other country, that's significant, right? So sometimes we need to establish our benchmarks more clearly.
So you think that this is what's producing the anxiety around industrial policy?
In terms of industrial policy, it is true that if you look at Silicon Valley, Boston, there was less of an overt industrial policy explaining the development of Silicon Valley and Boston. 128, but let's face it, right? So MIT benefited tremendously from federal funding,
for sure.
And DARPA created the
internet. So
DARPA, and so it's not explicitly designed to, you know, increase the trade surplus,
right?
So this is where the mercantilism comes in,
right?
And the mercantilism is an idea that first you use the government directly, explicitly to advance economic goals. And secondly, you focus on trade, right? So China has a flavor of both, and that worries people here.
And it's for me, it's surprising to hear people in the U.S. keep on talking about Chinese government's role at funding all this research, funding all those, putting all this money to work, as if that made a huge difference. If I look at the actual facts of how Tencent, Alibaba become amongst the most valuable company in the world, they have very little, like this much government funding.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not, almost no impact at all. Those two companies can do well if the government doesn't bother them.
Yeah,
and they work hard to make sure the government doesn't bother them too much and to find a way to coexist.
So many of China's internet companies were founded by people who were either Americanized or actually had been in the United States for an awfully long time.
Like Robin Lee for Baidu.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, with American venture capital listing on American...
And most people who were making money from Tencent and Baidu and Alibaba
were
Rise
Americans,
were
right.
Americans and people from outside of China.
Right. Preaching to the choir, man.
Yeah, try to make that argument with Trump, right?
Yeah,
very difficult.
Yeah. I do want to ask you about the trade number. You know, Trump says $500 billion. You know, I think the real number, you know, the nominal number is 350 maybe. But then,
I think focusing on that number is a mistake, right?
Okay.
So whether it's 500 or 300, the reason is that fundamentally, the trade imbalances with China are driven by the difference in savings rate.
Exactly.
Right? So if you don't incur $500 billion or $300 billion of trade imbalances with China, then you have to do that with somebody else. Right.
Right.
If you want to borrow that money, if you want to, you know, if you want people to show up at your treasury auction.
You consume a lot, right, relative to your savings rate. That means, by definition, you have to sort of borrow, and
from
then
somewhere.
That's a deficit, right? So essentially, it's the difference between the capital account, which is importing the money from the rest of the world, and the trade account, which is the deficit, right? China has exactly the opposite,
problem.
Right? So if China doesn't have a huge... So everything else being equal at its current level, if China doesn't have this huge trade surplus with United States, then the savings and investment and consumption ratios are such that it has to have a trade surplus
with someone,
or Chinese consumer can spend more and consume more.
That's a legitimate discussion to have, which is the discussion is really about why you need to have such a big trade surplus in the first place, rather than whether or not this is the right way to deal with it. So that discussion has to do with the consumption balance, consumption issues, and maybe you're investing too much, maybe you're not consuming enough, right? That's a legitimate discussion to have.
I wish the discussion is around that. Because as VCs, we actually actively fund companies that are riding the consumption upgrade wave in China. We want to see consumers consume more, not just locally, but from the rest of the world as well.
Yeah. So that's a both analytically right discussion to have, as well as a economically meaningful discussion to have. Right. So
agree.
For people like you and you know, for my relatives in China, I wish that they could consume more. So the discussion there is what is constraining their consumption and why their savings rate is so high, and that's a but
lack of a social safety net.
That's a social safety net. Yeah. So, but that's a discussion that's about domestic policy issues rather than about cross-border policy issues. So, country to country, they typically don't have those discussions.
No, they don't. Even though, I mean, I think it's interesting to note that if you are going to slap a bunch of tariffs on you, is it really going to hurt China so much, or is it just going to accelerate the rebalancing?
My own view is that it is hurting China more than it is hurting the U.S.
Interesting.
Right. So strictly in economic terms. So if you think about what the U.S. is, what kind of products they are imposing tariffs on, these are from Chinese industries that are competing with the U.S. industry.
Right.
So essentially, China sort of, in economics, we distinguish between absolute advantages and comparative advantages. China has a comparative advantage in light industry, labor-intensive industry, but it is producing these, you know, AI companies, drone companies, DJI, you know, companies like that, that are gaining in terms of absolute advantages vis-a-vis the U.S. Companies. So the U.S. is targeting those guys, and those are competing with the U.S. companies, whereas the Chinese imports from the U.S. are basically complementary with Chinese society, Chinese businesses. you know, we're talking about soybeans, yeah. right? So soybeans...
agricultural goods.
Yeah, agricultural goods, right? So soybeans go into tofu, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. Is that one of the applications? There may be other applications.
A lot of it. It ends up as pig. Also, doujiang.
Doujiang,
yeah, sure. Yeah, doujiang. So,
you know, yeah, so if you think about the supply chain, right? So essentially, soybean is the upstream product.
Right.
Doujiang is the downstream product, uh-huh. right? And your mouth is at the very end of the downstream. So, and so that's one. So essentially, it is complementary. And the other effect on China is agriculture is a part of the core inflation, right? So China cannot afford to have, you know, inflation,
right?
So.
Right.
So
it really does hurt China.
It does have more of an impact on the Chinese macroeconomic situation than it does on the United States. And also, if you look at the size, right, China depends on the U.S. in terms of the export much more than the other way around, right? So if you just cut off all the trade, right, you know, U.S. is losing $150 billion. China is losing, you know, whatever, 500, right? Something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So it does have a bigger effect on China than it does on the United States.
Yeah, I'm tempted to do
politically, it will be, I think a lot of times trade war is about politics, right? So basically, who is going to blink first, right? So there, I don't really have a very good way of reading the situation. To the extent that I have to say something about it, I will say the following, which is we typically think democratic societies are more vulnerable to political backlash,
sure.
right? Because businesses, people speak up, right? People who are losing from trade wars speak up. Mm-hmm. In an authoritarian society, you don't have that. So typically we say that a democratic country has a lower tolerance for pain, right? And so there's actually research that shows that democracies don't go to war with each other, right. in part because they have a low tolerance
right.
for
which
pain.
Which is good.
Which is good, which is one of the reasons I support democracy.
Correct.
Whereas in China, you know, you censor this, you censor that. Even if you have pain, you don't express it. In this particular situation, though, I'm not so sure.
The pain is manifest. It's there when you go to the grocery store or when you go to the market.
Well,
in the morning,
Trump is not targeting consumer products, at least for now.
Only for now.
He's targeting industrial products.
So
right?
far, right?
That
now.
Will have a feed-on effect.
But I'm talking about China's own levying of pork, corn. And,
oh, yeah. So that's directly affecting the consumers, right?
Right.
So
exactly.
But
right.
but if that society has a higher tolerance for pain, right, then one would imagine that it is going to be the U.S. who is going to blink first, right?
So let's talk about what they're targeting in the U.S.
U.S. business will complain more.
Well, so this is where it's getting interesting. U.S. businesses, unlike before, are not split on China. Mm-hmm. So before, 10 years ago, the U.S. business community was almost unified in terms of supporting
China open
trade
up.
And yep. investments trade, with okay. China, opening MFN, right?
Yes.
Most favored nation trading
yep.
status, WTO,
yep.
and all of that,
yep.
and not going after China in the aftermath of Tiananmen,
yep.
right? U.S. business community was unified.
Yep. Now, engage China, China
engage
will be better.
With China, yep. and so essentially what is known as engagement policy.
Right. The Clinton administration.
The Clinton yep. Administration.
Yep.
And even George.
George W. Bush.
George H.W. Bush.
Yep.
But the business community now is split.
The reason it has split is because China has increasingly become more buy local. You have to sell
yeah,
stuff
that's
in,
right.
in China. And it's made harder over the last 5-10 years for foreign companies to do more business in China.
Correct.
There are exceptions. Like Apple's doing well and Starbucks doing well and you know, in general, Pepsi's doing well. There are exceptions that are doing well.
Caterpillar is doing well.
Caterpillar's doing well. But for the most part, like, you know, even IBM, Microsoft, to some extent, are being affected by Chinese government wants everything buy local. In some sense, you can argue that the Trump trade war demands and situation is making China think harder about being a global citizen.
Yeah.
So, and so in some sense, and we see this in internet investing all the time, you want to have two powers or companies or countries kind of compete against each other
yeah.
to keep each other honest. They don't have to be nice. They have to respect and fear each other to do the right things. And in that respect, from our program of VCs, we don't mind that.
Yeah, but hence it can get out of the control, right?
Yes,
so
it can.
Essentially, it's a high stake.
It's a high stake poker game,
right? And it's a high stake poker game, and it could have that kind of effect that you want, and definitely that will be the effect I want.
We all want. That's
but
right.
You never know.
You never know.
So
the risk it has increased a lot.
The risk has it's just in the last few days,
yes.
Right? So now Trump is escalating this to 100. Billion.
That's right.
So how do you, if you walk down from 50 billion,
yep.
Right, you know, even as an MIT professor, I know something about math, right? So then you go down to 25. Now it's 150 billion.
Right. It got worse.
Right. So you essentially frame the discussion at a higher level.
Right.
Once you frame that discussion, and also this is something that I have noticed in China. I mean, there are young Chinese here. The young Chinese in China are much more nationalistic than when I was a young Chinese.
Right. Because you have seen something.
I was young before.
Right. Right? So,
we were all nationalistic back during, you know, the founding of the...
No, I was
we
were not the, as much.
I was not nationalistic.
Because you see the shortcoming of the system back then.
Yeah.
So you were more objective.
Right. So we were closer to the Cultural Revolution, so we
correct.
Kind of knew what that system was
how
bad
doing,
it could be.
Right?
Right.
So
that's right.
The current generation, you know, they play games. They don't really know that.
They shop right? online.
They shop online, right?
Great experiences overall.
And also... I think they have this sort of a wrong view about what GDP means, right? So the size of the GDP is big, right? The second in the world. But per capita GDP is right in the middle of 198 countries
right.
in the world. So China is sort of a middle-ish right. kind of a country. In the end, it's per capita GDP that matters.
Yes.
It's not the aggregate GDP.
Right. No.
Right? So...
And just speaking from personal experience, I think Chinese students of my generation who come to the U.S. to study actually want to go back these days because
yeah.
things actually work in China. They want to contribute. They want to make a lot of money. There are more opportunities there. It's harder to get a U.S. visa now. So there are
okay.
lots of push and pull factors that are pulling them back home. And I think part of the reason for the reason why Chinese tech companies can grow so fast is because they can attract all these Western educated
sure.
talents.
Yeah, so I think that's a very good thing, and I celebrate young people's aspirations and all of that. I just want to say that sometimes we need to be more cool-headed
yeah,
about
more
these
cautious.
About these macro issues,
objective.
Right? So.
Yeah.
I think don't translate the microeconomic optimism so blindly into macroeconomic optimism, right?
Okay.
So I think there's, you know, China still has a lot of children in the countryside who are not being educated.
Correct.
60 million left behind children. So
yep.
the country, you know,
still
has
still
some challenges. Has a lot of challenges.
Overcome right? the challenges.
Yeah,
that's
has a
right.
lot of challenges. So I just think that, and I would argue that if the young technologists from China think about making money, that's great, but also think about how to use technology to solve these social problems, that would be also very good too, right?
I want to thank this week's sponsor, Casper Mattresses. We were delighted when Casper began supporting us. They make great mattresses that you buy online. Seneca listeners are invited to take advantage of Casper's competitive, limited-time Memorial Day sale offer. Their mattresses are cleverly designed to mimic human curves, providing supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. Casper's breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amount of both sink and bounce. The Wave features a patent-pending premium support system to mirror the natural shape of your body. And the Essential has a streamlined design at a price that won't keep you up at night. All of Casper's models are available at affordable prices because Casper cuts out the middleman and sells directly to you. And Casper mattresses are even more affordable right now with a Memorial Day offer to sweeten the start of your summer. You buy and chillax with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep on a trial, and returns are hassle-free if you're not completely satisfied. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, and Google, Casper is fast becoming the internet's favorite mattress. The mattresses are delivered right to your door in a small, how-do-they-do-that-sized box, and you can be sure on your of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. So please go to casper.com/savings. That's casper.com/savings to receive 10% off your order with any mattress purchase. This special offer expires May 29th, 2018. Terms and conditions apply. casper.com/savings to receive 10% off your order with any mattress purchase. This special offer expires on May 29, 2018. Terms and conditions apply. Now, on with the show.
I want to ask you a couple of questions. First I want to ask you about Americans' likely reactions, and I think, Zara, you should ask about Chinese people's reactions to the burgeoning trade war. Now, in the United States, China has obviously targeted not just red states, not just swing states that went for Trump. You know, obviously Boeing is not in a red state; it's in a very blue state. But corn, again, soybeans, and pork, these do target states that have been traditionally pro-Trump. Is this a smart strategy? Or is this going too far? Is this crossing a line? Is this going to look like meddling in American politics? How are Americans likely to respond to this? And maybe has China picked a too obnoxious strategy?
I think so. The one issue is what is the alternative, right? So I think this is as a smart strategy as you can. As you can play
under the circumstances,
but I have a feeling. You know, I may be wrong. I have often been wrong. I have a feeling that it may not work this time. Mm-hmm. Trump is not a conventional politician. His supporters, there may be some here, but I don't know. But his supporters are not super clear about their true economic interests, right? So, and you know. Many of their supporters would have a lot to gain from Obamacare, and he's the one who promised to demolish Obamacare. So the economic calculations may not work this time with him. So I was going to finish my earlier example about sort of the political capacity to bear pain. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I actually think Trump has quite a bit of political capacity to bear pain.
Evidently.
If you look at his... well, the Mueller investigation. So, what's wrong with offending 1.4 billion people, right? So, what more can they do? And also, if you look at his approval rating is rising, right in the middle of the trade war.
Right.
So, and also the business community is more split than before. Mm-hmm. And there is more of a bipartisan consensus about this particular issue than there was before. Right. Even the Democrats support some of the tariffs.
So we're going to go out for a cocktail tonight, and we have to decide between a Moscow Mueller or a dark and stormy Daniels. Sure. Maybe a white Russian interference.
I won't go there.
Yeah, so we won't go there. You can drink by yourself.
I'm ripping off jokes from my little brother from Facebook. Anyway, sorry about the joke.
So, Professor Huang, how do you think the ordinary people in China are reacting to this? Are they rallying around the flag and boycotting Americans?
What's that hashtag that I keep seeing now?
What is it?
We didn't grow up. Chinese did not grow up out of fear. So it's whatever you want to do. You know, give us more.
Yeah, bring it on.
Bring it on.
Bring it, bitch. It's just like that kind of thing.
Again, that's Kaiser speaking.
Exactly. We don't take any responsibility. That's not 996.
I can beep it. I'll beep it. I'm sorry.
Well, I think my own view, I'm a professor, so I can say these things, which is that I think the biggest fear is the lack of fear, right? And I think China, so if you look at Chinese economic growth, right? If you look at Chinese macroeconomic picture, we are talking about an economy that is still heavily dependent on investment-driven growth.
Right.
Right. Consumption GDP, household consumption GDP ratio is about, you know, 40-39%, which is actually very low compared with major economies in the world.
Yep. The U.S. and Japan.
So to sort of have more sustainable growth, you need to decrease the investment, you need to increase the consumption, mm-hmm. and you need to have a healthy export mm-hmm. Growth.
That's right.
Right. So if you curtail export now, right, to keep the growth rate as it is, you know, 6.5, 6.7, the only thing available to the policymakers is to increase the investment.
Mm-hmm. More FAI, right?
More FAI. And right. then that means more bank loans,
more local
debt-driven growth, more printing of the money. So the two parts of the economy that are healthy, the household consumption and the exports, we need both of them, right? So I would, you know, I, again, as a professor, I would just swallow the bitterness, whatever. I would just say, okay, so let's just have a compromise, and rather than sort of playing on this psychological nationalistic sentiment.
Right.
I think that's very, very dangerous,
right.
Because nationalism has never been a friend to economic.
Right. From where we sit, kind of see that the chance of Trump changing position, you know, because he always do stuff you just don't expect.
Yeah.
So there's a possibility that he will change. You look at China, it can change somewhat, but not too much.
Okay.
So what was most likely happen, in our view, at least in my personal view, is that things will get nastier for a while and see which side can take on more pain and make adjustments accordingly. And it makes the whole thing a lot riskier than ever before. But we could see this prolong for a while.
In the long run, do you think this whole episode will go down in history as a hiccup in the bigger trend of globalization? Or do you think globalization is actually stoppable by individual leaders?
Globalization has been stopped before.
By individual leaders.
By wrong policy choices. If you look at...
You're talking about the Smoot-Hawley tariff.
Smoot-Hawley tariff. Yeah. And if you look at the sort of the cross-border investments as a share of worldwide GDP, the world reached a peak in just before the First World War.
Right.
Right.
And then for the next 50 years and 60 years, it went downhill.
It went downhill.
Right. So, you know, maybe with hands around, things will be different. Who knows, right? So... But I'm not a blind optimist, right? So if you make wrong policy decisions, you can really go down a path that you regret later. So in terms of your question, whether or not this is a short-term hiccup or not, I actually don't think this is a short-term thing. And I think, you know, sometimes we distinguish between structural component and cyclical component. In the past, the U.S.-China relationship has been governed by cyclical up and down,
right?
Cyclical
with
up and down.
A high degree of codependency.
But structurally, it was moving in a positive direction.
Right?
So you have this sort of up and down, but you know the long-term
trend lines are moving.
The trend line is moving in the right direction.
Right.
I'm not so sure, precisely because I see more evidence of bipartisan consensus getting harsher on China,
right?
Trump, obviously, but also business community being split, right? And from the Chinese side, more nationalism, strong leadership, the country also, in my own view, is not implementing economic reforms as fast as they should, mm-hmm. right?
But reforms, market opening. You mean market liberalization?
Market liberalization, right?
So, foreign companies
or what about regulatory reform?
Yeah. So if you look at FDI as a measure of some sort of liberalization, that has been pretty flat.
Right.
Yeah. So more worrisome is the component of the total FDI inflow. In the early 1990s, sort of mid-1990s, much of the Chinese FDI was money coming from Hong Kong. No, from
the
Hong
other
Kong
Chinese.
Taiwan, went Singapore. Taiwan, Singapore.
70%, you know, yes. Something like that. And then it went down because Western companies, yeah. Western companies began to invest. Japan, right. Europe, US, Germany, Europe. Yeah. United States.
Yep.
Now we're coming back to the situation in the early 1990s.
Yep.
The Hong Kong investments are outpacing Japanese investments, U.S. investments, and European investments, right?
Wow.
So, you know, I have nothing against the Hong Kong investments, but I would argue that the U.S. investments, European investments, Japanese investments bring to China technology and you know, management in a way I don't think Hong Kong investments can do that.
Right, they're more indicative of broader global integration.
Correct.
But I think what's different now than before for China is that We all hope China would do more economic reforms because it helps to have a safer world when it's more balanced. But what the signs we do see is that instead of choosing between being more militaristic and being more antagonistic versus economic reform, there's a third route, which is a One Belt, One Road campaign. Is that instead of depending on U.S. for export, why don't we sell more of our service business model and goods to Southeast Asia, to
Central Asia,
India, to Central Asia, to Eastern Europe, to Africa, to even Latin America? I think over the next 10, 20 years, you will see a lot more push by Chinese government aligning with the Chinese internet company to export and to expand into these other developing markets.
Yeah.
That's why the chance of more Chinese company coming to the U.S. is less than more of these Chinese internet company going out to these other developing markets in the world will increase dramatically.
Hans, this has felt very Seneca. Let's move this more to 996 territory and talk more about tech investment and stuff like that, right? What do you think? Is it time to shift it into that?
Sure.
Let's do that.
Professor Wang, you spend a lot of time studying Chinese private enterprises as well. And you start with looking at SOEs early.
Yeah.
And then start shifting to the private enterprises. And then even with the China Lab, look at the Chinese internet companies. As you see shift from SOEs to private enterprise to internet companies, do you see the quality of management team, the sophistication of management systems, and the growth change quite a bit?
Is it commensurate with the change in?
Yeah. So this is an excellent question. So I founded China Lab and India Lab in 2008, and since then it has been 10 years. We have worked with about 300. Chinese companies now, about 70 Indian companies now. So as an academic, it's actually extremely hard to study management because we don't have data. Through the work I did in China Lab, I did have
access
to Chinese entrepreneurial companies.
Yes.
The shift from sort of 10 years ago, essentially, if you look at the type of projects we are doing vis-a-vis the type of projects we were doing 10 years ago, 10 years ago, most of the projects we were doing were about marketing overseas. You know, I have a product, I want to sell to Japan, I want to sell to US, and you have a team, please help us, you know, come up with a marketing plan, you know, how to sell overseas. Increasingly, the projects are about management, improving the management, human resource management, financial reporting controls, devising KPIs, things like that, mm-hmm. right? So essentially, there's a dramatic shift from the external orientation of these companies to internal capacity building mm-hmm. on the part of the companies we work with. I think, you know, this is not a systematic piece of data, but it is systematic enough to tell me that the Chinese entrepreneurial companies now put more value, more premium on management, right? So also before, if you look at Chinese private sector companies, they had a simple structure.
Right.
One boss, everybody was a worker, right? So essentially there's a missing management.
Right.
I would say 20 years ago, it was irrational for Chinese to go to business school
right.
because
there's no way
there's
to put it
you know
practice.
You can't be a worker right. Although some should, but they don't want to be a worker
right.
And they can't be the boss
right. No
immediately right.
There's
so there's no management. There's no marketing manager. There's
right.
no finance. So the boss is doing everything by himself or herself. Now you have a more sophisticated managerial system now. You have top management, you have middle management, you have line management. And I think this is really reflecting the dynamism and the rising quality of the Chinese private sector.
Correct. Right?
So part of it is, I think part of it is when the economy is more competitive, right? You can't just rely on connections and government connections, although there's still
some, right?
So you cannot just rely on that. You have to rely on management know-how, but also technology, right? Technology is playing more and more important role. In our China Lab projects in the last three years, I would say the ratio, the percentage share of the technology projects are now 70%.
Not surprising.
Yeah, so
internet-related or technology.
Internet-related, all sorts of, you know, even the real estate projects have a piece of technology So I think definitely on at that level, Chinese economy is so I tend actually not to look at these macro numbers,
right.
Like GDP and all of that. I actually think that these microeconomic indicators are a more reliable indicator of healthier, how Chinese economy is getting healthier.
Yashil, you spent a lot of time looking at India, and of course you run the India Lab as well.
Yeah, sure.
I'm really curious about your impressions of either just sort of qualitative or quantitative, from having worked with both the China Lab and the India Lab at the State of Entrepreneurship, and make some comparative, be totally politically incorrect and talk about the Chinese and the Indian engineering style, the management style, the entrepreneurial style.
Yeah. So I also run India Lab, and it's so just as an anecdote, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, when China Lab and India Lab began, mostly we had Indian students doing India Lab, Chinese students doing China Lab. Mm-hmm. Now it's just the opposite. Now the Chinese students want to do India Lab.
Right.
The Indian students want to do China Lab.
Not surprised at all.
And they are more curious about each other. And by the way, I got interested in India a long time ago, and I was criticized for being optimistic about India. But I think that, India has, within the huge constraints it is facing, has done
well,
right? So it is now able to grow 7%. That's actually very impressive for India.
Oh, sure.
Because before, there's a term called the Hindu rate of the growth.
Yep.
It's like economic conferences, if you say, oh, this country is growing at Hindu rate of the growth, it doesn't have to be about India. It can be about country X. The people, everybody nods the head, okay, 1%, right? So everybody knows, sort of knows that. But now it's 7%. 7%, we're talking about East Asian growth.
Yes.
Right? So with the savings rate, about half of the Chinese savings rate, with the investment rate, half about Chinese investment rate.
Right.
You're growing 80% of the Chinese growth rate. That's actually not bad.
Right? I take responsibility for this. I did ask him to be politically incorrect, and then he obliged.
Was I politically correct?
East Asian rate versus the Hindu rate. Yeah, I mean,
these are technical terms.
Uh-huh. Come on, Kaiser. I'm a small personal investor in two Indian companies.
Yeah.
One is Flipkart.
Yeah.
One is not
okay.
Number one, number two Indian e-commerce companies. Yeah. And when I look at them, especially Snapdeal, and I see even other Indian VCs and leading tech startups, they actually spend a lot of time coming to China and meeting with Chinese VCs, meeting with Chinese entrepreneurs. They actively want to learn and get knowledge about what has happened in China, because they feel that a lot of big urbanization problems that they were trying to solve in India, somebody in China has solved a similar problem already.
Yeah.
And now the local adaptation would be very different, for sure. But a lot of principles and lessons learned actually be quite valuable. It reminds me how the Chinese team used to come to Silicon Valley and
learn from
American companies.
Is it happening the other way, though? Are any of your portfolio companies here in China?
Alibaba, well, I don't know about
Xiaomi is number
companies.
One.
Yeah. Xiaomi is number one smartphone.
Right. I know that in India. As a market, but are they looking at it for sort of to learn management? I mean, there's got to be some reason why so many more Indians are making it into the senior management of major Silicon Valley companies.
I think it's two different issues.
Okay.
I think the Chinese company are looking at India as a market to expand. For sure.
I think
that there are more Indian executives who have done well in Silicon Valley that may never change, at least not for a while. But what I think, what partially because most successful, a lot of successful, not most, a lot of successful, promising Chinese engineers or product manager end up going back to China instead of staying here, stuck it out. And for the Indian executives, being here has better payoff up until now. But as India grow, it could change. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about India is that more and more American executives who have done well in US, in Silicon Valley, are more willing to invest heavily into India. Like Amazon is investing in India in a way that they never would dare to try and waste, quote unquote, waste money and be irrational for China. But look at the value market cap of JD.com, 80, 90 billion. That's what Amazon give up by not being in China. So we see a lot more competition in India now between American companies, Indian local startups, and Chinese companies.
Okay.
Beyond India, do you think the other emerging markets around the world will look more like China or more like the US as they develop? And how optimistic are you about the ability of Chinese companies to expand into those markets like Southeast Indonesia, Asia, Eastern Europe, Indonesia, Middle East, Northern Africa?
These are technology companies, not SOEs.
Yeah, technology companies.
Yeah. I should defer to Hans.
Based on what you have seen with China Lab and India Lab, what do you think?
I think the Chinese companies tend to. So I know a little bit more about Chinese companies in the US than I do about Chinese companies in Indonesia. So the Chinese companies, unlike Japanese companies which came to the US in the 1980s, the Chinese companies tend to have a separate operation in the United States as compared with their home operations in China. The management team is separate. They typically have an American at the head of the US operation, right? Some companies are not like that, but
that's
quite
key
a few.
Post.
Yeah, key post. Key post, right? Yeah. And they don't quite impose Chinese managerial method on their US operations, right? Whereas if you compare that with Japan.
Or Korea.
Korea, right? Japan, lean manufacturing, right? Zero inventory, and they impose even the jugong, you know, so the
morning
exercise. Morning exercise, right? The bowing, right? So the just imagine doing that in Ohio, right? So
this movie called Gung Ho, yes.
Gung Ho, yeah, Gung Ho, that's right, Gung Ho. So the Honda opened its plant in Ohio in 1987. Right. Imagine in Ohio, 1987. Right. With Americans there bowing, you know, to the boss, and they actually impose these things on their U.S. Factories. Right. Chinese companies don't do that. So.
Yeah, none of that 996 nonsense. Right?
What's a 996?
Yeah, you can tell Kaiser really does not subscribe to 996.
I'm joking. It's just 9 to 9, 6 days a week.
Oh, I see. Working hours. Yeah. So I think there the Chinese managerial approach is quite different, right? So it is, you know, for a time I served on the board of a Chinese investment company, and they pretty much left the company alone, right? Rather than exercising an active managerial voice, right? We can debate whether that's the right thing to do, but that's what I see, right? So maybe when they go to Indonesia, they may be more hands-on. I just don't know. But I do know that Alibaba is investing in India, Paytm,
And Alibaba also invests in Tokopedia in Indonesia and acquired Lazada.
Yeah, so I don't really know how interventionist Alibaba is.
It's mixed. With Tokopedia, they're not hands-on at all. With Lazada, since it's 100% acquired, they're more hands-on. So both are happening.
Yeah.
Hey, Cynical listeners. We want to thank this week's special sponsor, United Airlines. United is the number one airline flying between the U.S. and China, with more flights to more destinations in China than any other U.S. carrier. It's 89 flights each week to China, with service to Beijing, Shanghai, Chengdu, and Hong Kong. And United now offers its customers 2 free checked bags on flights to and from China and Hong Kong. You should also check out the great low fares they're now offering from the U.S. to China and to Hong Kong until June 10th. Visit united.com/China and united.com/Hong Kong for details. United is a founding member of Star Alliance, whose members include Air China. That means you get frequent flyer program reciprocity, and benefits like airport lounge access. 2 free checked bags. You hear that, Fanfan? You have no idea how happy my wife is about this. Now back to the show.
So how do you think the relationship between tech and government differs between the U.S. and China? I feel like in the U.S., Washington, D.C. is often at loggerheads with Silicon Valley, whereas in China, the interests of tech and the government seems to be more aligned. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think in the U.S., whether the loggerheads is the right word to use, I don't know, but there is a distance between Silicon Valley took a pride in the fact that it is not located on the East Coast, right?
Right.
So, but now they are now more realistic now. They have Washington.
Everybody has offices.
Operations.
Yeah, Washington and New York.
Because the government is going to regulate, right? Mm-hmm. What happened at Facebook. And, mm-hmm. and so if you don't work with the government, the mm-hmm. government will come to you.
That's right?
And so I think even the tech sector in the U.S. has to be realistic about the role of the government. The government is not going to go away. I think, you know, whether that's good or bad, that's a separate discussion. The government is not going to go away.
Right. And if anything, it could be even more active going
it
forward.
Could be even more active, right? So we talk about the current wave of technology potentially producing huge winners, but also a lot of losers.
Yes,
right?
So and those, the gap could be widening.
The gap could be widened, right? So the government has to play a role.
Yep.
In China, I think, you know, if you look at Alibaba, maybe this is an old story now, but Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, it is absolutely true, as Hans pointed out, when they first developed, they didn't really have any meaningful relationship with the government, right? So Alibaba was backed by SoftBank.
By SoftBank,
right?
And the government did not
and
stop that.
And Tencent was backed by
South Africa.
That's right, yeah. Right. And Baidu, yeah. I don't.
Baidu was mostly by VCs, all yeah. with US LPs.
So all the partners. All the US, right? So not
all US.
The question is, now they are getting so big, right? Now they are getting so big, you know, Alibaba now is in finance and in all these areas, whether or not the government is going to get more involved, right? There is evidence that the government is getting more
showing
involved,
more interest to be more.
Showing more interest in getting involved. So
right.
then how do you structure that relationship is going to be an interesting issue, right? Mm-hmm. You definitely don't want to get involved so far to kill them, mm-hmm. right? But on the other hand, they are doing so many things, the government has to sort of get involved, right? So that's one kind of involvement. The other kind of involvement that I see more of in China than I do in the United States is government-run venture capital funds invest very aggressively in early stage startups, right? You don't see that in the United States.
Right. Right?
You have, you know, one CIA fund, right?
CIA fund?
I can't tell.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So
I can tell.
The fact I had never heard of it means that probably it's not happening very frequently, right?
So
the U.S. Department of Energy has loan programs,
right?
But that's different from equity investments. Whereas in China, Shenzhen Capital, right? You know,
there are a few RMB funds that raise money from local
governments.
There
are quite a few, and they're actually quite big. Mm-hmm. They're quite big, and I actually think if you look at that model is closer to the Israel model than to the U.S. model.
Mm-hmm.
In Israel,
mm-hmm. that's right. Mm-hmm.
In the 1970s, mm-hmm. this is how they invested in the early startups.
And jumpstart the VC industry.
Jumpstart the tech industry in Israel. Not government as an investor, but the key difference that I see, maybe the difference is not as big, but there could be a difference. The difference is that in the case of Israel, the government was a more of a passive investor.
Mm-hmm.
It relied on the judgment of the
general partners.
Yeah, the general partners,
the
right?
General
so
managers
the government funds. Kind of took a back seat. Whereas in China, maybe the government is more active. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I don't think
I don't think the government's more active.
Yeah.
But also, if I look at the playing field, amongst the top 50 VCs in China, I would say probably 30 of them are U.S. backed by U.S. limited
LPs,
partners, U.S.
Least,
LPs,
yeah.
U.S. investors.
Okay.
Probably 20, the ratio is probably 20 of RMB funds that are doing well. And of those 20, I would say less than half are backed by some kind of government money.
I see, okay. But I also think that it is not the wrong thing to do for the government to back these early startups.
Early funds, yes.
Yeah. The reason is that, so we talk about China 2025, so a lot of the industry China wants to develop are connected to manufacturing, you know, energy, right? These are huge investments.
Capital intensive sectors.
Yeah. I actually wish to see more of that in the US.
Right.
So what you see is a lot of investments in internet related things, maybe in AI now, and life science. Anything in between actually doesn't attract
thing I do worry is that the skill set it takes to get money from government officials, whether it's in the US and China, is a different skill set from designing best product, designing best customer service, designing ecosystem.
Yeah.
So while I want to see government invest in the right funds, in my heart of heart, I still like to see the private sector or insurance companies or pension funds or university endowments play a more active role, kind of the way that your U.S. has.
So I actually think that I agree with everything that you said.
The only thing I would say, though, I think, for example, let's take DJI drones versus the U.S. drones as an example. I think where the U.S. drones lose out is not that there was no government funding supporting them to fight against DJI, because DJI doesn't have any government funding either in China. I think what's the big difference is that U.S. is lacking that manufacturing infrastructure.
That's right.
So that it's not helping those drone components. It's not helping those companies that are, the sectors that are manufacturing dependent to do better.
Yeah, so I actually think this is one of the huge advantages that China has.
Exactly.
The co-location between technology and manufacturing, mm-hmm. right? So if you look at around Boston, where do you see manufacturing? You don't see manufacturing. If you look around Silicon Valley, you don't see manufacturing.
Less and less.
It is, lack of manufacturing is okay for particular kind of technologies, right?
For internet, software, or right? Networking, e-commerce.
Maybe life science, yeah. I'm not sure, right? But you know, energy, capital equipment,
and semiconductors,
you really need both large-scale manufacturing mm-hmm. and small-scale manufacturing.
This is even biotech. I mean, it's true.
Maybe even biotech. Yeah.
You know, so, China's manufacturing gene sequencing machines right now, and they're no longer. Right.
So Shenzhen. You know, there's no reason why Shenzhen cannot be a manufacturing version of Silicon Valley.
Right.
So, there's a book by actually MIT graduate Bunny Huang about hardware innovations in Shenzhen, right?
Yeah, he's a famous hardware hacker. Really,
he's a famous hardware hacker.
He's written a lot about the Shenzhen culture.
Shenzhen is really interesting. So we tend to think about Shenzhen as just copying. What he says is that it's much more than copying.
Yeah,
right? It's incremental incremental innovations on top of a basic model, and they make it 1,000 times better. Right, that margin of improvement is all because of this incredible ecosystem of having a lot of technologists involved, a lot of manufacturers involved,
and a lot of consumers.
And a lot of consumers.
So you can iterate and try many things.
That's Tencent right. started with borrowing other people's products, basically, right. And they call that micro-innovation.
Right.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the impact of the so-called fourth industrial revolution in the United States and in China. I mean, if you look at all the major technologies that are obviously going to be disruptive, I mean, we've already mentioned a few of these, you know, advanced robotics, AI, genomics, and especially gene editing, CRISPR-Cas9 and things like that. The two countries that are really at the forefront are China and the United States, and it's the private sectors of both. They don't seem to really be talking to one another.
Yeah.
And these are really important things where interoperability, standards, where ethics issues really need to be in autonomous driving, things like that. I mean, all these things are going to be really important. Is this an area where we're going to see sort of divergence and in a lack of interoperability, or do you think that this is a potential area for bilateral cooperation, or does it even matter?
Oh, I think it matters tremendously.
Yeah, I hope.
Yeah. So, and if you look at the AI, there are some deep, profound socioeconomic implications with the arrival of AI. You mentioned privacy, right? Well, Hans mentioned privacy, you know.
With the impact on labor, right?
Yeah, so but that's one set of issues. Right. But that kind of thing can be country-specific, right? Chinese may not value privacy as much as Americans. But in terms of the effect on labor market,
right?
And truckers, you know, autonomous driving,
yep,
right?
So, long-distance truckers.
You know, China is still a you know, 1.4 billion people and a lot of laborers, and there are still farmers, and so if you just sort of think about how you make this transition from low income or middle income to high income, you still need conventional industrialization, right? You have employment and all of that. So failure to talk to each other, I think, and to think long-term about the rise of... So one of the things that I read about, you know, China 2025 and, you know, the visions, you read about the visions, you read about the industries, you read about the money, you know, all these things, you read about IP strategy and financing strategy. What you don't read is the implications on society,
mm-hmm.
right? The implications on labor
job
market.
Job placement, displacement.
And this is remarkable to me, right? So if you read Marvin Minsky's work on AI, he was an MIT professor,
yep.
going back to the 1960s, father of AI, he began to talk about these things back in the 1960s,
that's right?
Right?
Yep.
And I do believe that lack of that conversation, by the way, MIT now has a task force to study the effect of AI on labor market. I'm on that committee, and it's a except me, everybody else is impressive on that committee. It's just, you know, the disciplines the committee represents, it's a systematic effort to try to understand and anticipate these things. I just don't see any of that in China,
I was just add that I remember when Amazon Go, the unmanned convenience store by Amazon, opened, every article mentioned how many cashier jobs will be lost in the U.S., whereas when BingoBox or Portfolio Company in China opened their unmanned convenience store, and they have 300 of those now, none of those articles in China mentioned even like the word of cashier jobs. It's just less of a concern there.
What explains that cavalier attitude, though?
I'm not sure it's a cavalier. Is that as a country, there's a lot more people who are optimistic on how technology growth in China will narrow the gap between China and U.S. and some of the other countries.
And they have plenty of reason to believe that. I mean, they've only seen life improve as technology has improved.
They've seen a
perfect correlation between these two things.
Correct. So far, that's the case.
Right.
And now, as it continues to happen, will the government do a decent job of helping to solve that? And kind of keep whatever's not working hush hush, and it's easier to have that transition under an authoritarian government. You could argue that can happen faster, and people get used to it faster.
I'm sure Yashin has some a response to that.
Well, no, I'm not a fan
of authoritarianism.
Right? Yeah, I'm not a fan of authoritarianism, but I also think that I agree with Hans on this cultural difference. When I first came to the U.S., I was surprised to see movies such as Blade Runner,
right.
which portrays this very
dystopian
dark future.
Right.
Dystopian, right?
Right.
So
you gotta see Black Mirror.
Black Mirror, yeah.
So
So
it's very interesting in Western societies. I don't really know why. I should, you know, invest time in learning about that.
Well, it's Frankenstein.
Evil scientists, right?
There's a lot
of
healthy...
Working in the basement, you know, trying to destroy the world. Right. And there's a lot of that in the Western culture.
Well, there's still a lot of celebration for Renaissance and scientific revolution and all that. Both kind of, both respect and admiration and distrust exist.
I have a book you can start with. It's by a philosopher who used to be at NYU in Shanghai. Her name is Anna Greenspan. She wrote a book called Shanghai Future.
Right.
And she starts it off pointing out something really interesting. At the 1937 World's Fair and at the 2010 Expo in
Shanghai,
both had GM pavilions. One was GM, another... both were General Motors pavilions. Both of them were about future cities.
Right.
And, you know, that was 1937, and it was called Futurama. In the time since, Futurama is a byword just for cheesy sort of, you know, oh, my flying, oh, where's my jetpack? And I mean, spiral towers and stuff like that. In China, they're still in earnest embrace of this idea of that futurity, you know, is technologically driven, and it is a betterment of humanity, and it's really interesting.
I think there's a lot of scar from the Opium War, from other things that happened in the 19th century that make people feel like technology is good. Without technology, we will, you know, be defeated again. And that kind of imprint is extremely, extremely strong.
We're still embarrassed about the boxers, right?
but I also think that it's more general than that. Yeah. It's actually more general beyond technology. In the Western culture, there is always an obsession with the downside, right? Look at what lawyers do, right? You know, economics, it's all about
risk.
Scarcity, right? So trade-off and all of that. You always want to think about the downside, right? And then devise institutions. Democracy is actually to guard against downside, right? Check and balance and all
of
that.
Take the least of all evils.
Yeah, whereas in the Chinese culture, there's not this similar forward thinking about the downside.
There's more glorification about unification.
There's a glorification
of being an empire, of being strong and prosperous. Whereas in the West, it's a lot about, hey, this government is bad, or the king is bad. Yeah. Let's make sure he doesn't, you know, adversely impact us too much.
Yeah,
it's very different ethos.
In China, the sentiment goes like this. Okay, this king is bad, but next king is
will be better.
Will be great, right? So
there's always hope the next guy will be better, but you don't change the system itself. And I remember like watching the Olympics in Beijing in Summer Olympics in 2008.
Yeah.
The opening ceremony, Zhang Yimou had 20,000 people all moving unison. I'm like, dude, I wouldn't want to show that for the rest of the world.
Right. Because it's meant to inspire, but it really intimidates.
Intimidates a lot of people. Like, oh my God, you have all these people who are brainwashing to all move in the same direction. That is not a good thing you want to show about China. But it's just very different. And actually, all the Chinese entrepreneurs lie back, I know, they love that show.
Right.
They're modern. They're doing internet stuff, but they feel that is very natural. It's very different ethos, very different values.
Absolutely.
So I think we should have a broader conversation, right? You know, the privacy issues, how we think about technology, how we think about all these things, collectivism, right, vis-a-vis individualism. Yeah, we don't have enough of those conversations, which is too bad.
Professor Huang, you did a lot of research on the relationship between talent and economic development. I wonder, there are a lot of like Liu Xuesheng like me who've gone back and became haigui sea turtles and joined tech companies or started them. What do you think are factors that make them successful in China? Because not all of them are successful. They have a lot of adjustments to go through after they go back.
Well, so I don't know the individual cases, right? So I think as a cohort, the Haigui cohort is going to be very important for China.
Going forward.
Oh,
absolutely.
Right? So I think, but the key thing is, I think people like you, Zara, have to make a decision, right? You talked about JDC, right? So how local do you go, right?
Do you want to be?
And do you go all the way to the local things and lose your sort of Western educated...
Or globalness.
Yeah, globalist, right? So I would argue that China needs more of a globalist perspective and ideas than more MIT students, more Harvard students going back playing local guys, right? So China is not short of local people, right? But China is short of global perspective.
We want them to have experience in both markets.
So you don't necessarily want them like
the more returnees have experience in both local markets and U.S. markets. We think the better it is.
No, but there's a difference between experiencing local things and then totally agreeing with them.
Sure.
Right?
So absolutely.
It's okay to
occasionally eat huo guo in Chengdu with your shirt off on a hot summer day.
Is that what you do, Kaiser?
I do, but don't live that life, right?
Oh, okay. Oh, let me try that next time.
I'll take you to the
next time. I'm not going to be bothered.
Well, Professor Huang, thank you so much for joining us. And Kaiser, it's always fun to have you. And thank you so much to everyone in the audience for being here with us on a Saturday night.
Yeah, Saturday night.
I'm impressed.
All right, hey, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.